Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States and Mrs. Laura Bush.
Good to see you. Thank you all. Welcome everyone to the White House. Thanks to all our very distinguished guests for joining us tonight to celebrate Teddy Roosevelt's 150th birthday. President Roosevelt once said, "I don't think that any family has ever enjoyed the White House more than we have." Certainly, the antics of the Roosevelt children are White House legend. The president's youngest five slid down the stairs on stolen trays, peppered Andrew Jackson's portrait with spitballs, and turned the room where we now sit into a makeshift skating rink. They kept a zoo of pets, and they took their calico pony, Algonquin, upstairs in the White House elevator to visit their brother when he was sick. As White House Chief Usher Ike Hoover put it, a nervous person had no business around the White House in those days. President Roosevelt encouraged his children and often joined them for games in the White House attic, but the boyishly exuberant leader had limits to his patience, as when he caught his son Quentin trampling the flower bed with stilts. Upon being ordered out of the landscaping, Quentin complained to his father, "I don't see what good it does for me for you to be president." Here in the East Room, Quentin would burst out of vases to scare tourists like a jack-in-the-box. And the president's oldest child, Alice, would tell visitors that the president beat his children every day. News she imparted while draped with her pet snake, Emily Spinach. President Roosevelt must have been relieved when Princess Alice, as she became known, was finally married in the East Room. As the president once famously commented, he could control Alice, or he could be president of the United States, but he couldn't do both. For more than 100 years, the second floor of the White House was divided into office space for the president and living quarters for the first family. Roosevelt spent a year working in this arrangement, but quickly realized that official guests should not be forced to run a gauntlet of children to see the president of the United States. So in 1902, President Roosevelt began construction on a new executive office building, which became what we know as the West Wing. When President Roosevelt built the new office space, he expanded the family's living quarters into the vacated presidential offices. He created a new area on the east for receiving guests, maybe you came in that way, and he removed the grand staircase at the west end of the cross hall to enlarge the state dining room. This work was overseen by the architectural firm McKim, Mead & White, which decorated the White House in an elegant neoclassical style. Here in this room, their work is reflected not only in the plaster walls and polished wood floors, but also in the chandeliers above our heads, the gilded benches that are around flanking the room, the cornices above the draperies, and the light standards bordering the windows, all of which are original to the 1902 redecoration of the White House. There have been some additions over the years, including the portrait of President Roosevelt on my left, which was painted by John Singer Sargent in 1903. But even when the Truman administration gutted the entire White House in a dramatic renovation, the state floor was rebuilt in the style chosen by McKim, Mead & White and President Teddy Roosevelt. President Roosevelt had at least one regret from the massive project. According to his aide, he grumbled that architect Charles McKim and Mrs. Roosevelt forced him to accept stone lions' heads on the mantelpiece in the state dining room. President Roosevelt took 6 years to emerge victorious in this marital spat. In a 1908 letter to the architects, he demanded that the stone lion heads be recarved as bison heads, which he explained made a much more characteristic and American decoration. At tonight's reception, you'll see that American buffalo do adorn our mantle in honor of President Roosevelt's firm request. But before we move across the hall for the reception, John Milton Cooper is here to tell you more about President Roosevelt's life and presidency. Professor Cooper is the E. Gordon Fox Professor of American Institutions at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. His book, The Warrior and the Priest, is a comparative biography of Presidents Theodore Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson. Professor Cooper.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Mrs. Bush, Mr. President. It's a great honor to be here. I want to make you one promise right off. Unlike somebody who wrote in the New York Times this morning, I am not going to presume to know what Theodore Roosevelt would be thinking these days, or particularly about this election. As I say, the only prediction I'm going to make on this election is one that I made back in 1992, Mr. President, when I said, the winner of this election is going to be left-handed. The last time I was here for a White House reception was in October of 1992, when your parents very graciously had a reception for us here, and that was in honor of the 200th anniversary of the laying of the cornerstone of the White House. So it's a great pleasure to be back. Well, as you all know, we are here to commemorate the 150th anniversary of Theodore Roosevelt's birth. We might also remember that in 70 days, on January 5th, 2009, we will mark the 90th anniversary of his death. He was only 2 months past his 60th birthday when he died, younger than many people in this room, myself included. What a short life it was, and how much he packed into it. Crowded hour and strenuous life were two of his favorite phrases. And he also said, the joy of living is his who has the heart to command it. No one else in our history has ever had more heart to demand the joy of living, to make his life an unorthodox succession of crowded hours, an unbroken succession of crowded hours, and to lead the strenuous life to its utmost. From the very beginning, Theodore Roosevelt's life was the stuff of legend. He was a sickly child who overcame his physical weakness through determined exercise and outdoor pursuits. And he set an example that has inspired successive generations of American youth. He became an outdoorsman, a hunter, a naturalist. He originally wanted to be a scientist. Matter of fact, he wanted to be a wildlife biologist and was discouraged because no lab work was the thing in those days. He gave that up, but he was frankly the most scientifically literate president we've had since Thomas Jefferson. He was also a linguist. I think John Quincy Adams is probably the only president who spoke more languages. And I might add, Theodore Roosevelt taught himself Icelandic so that he could read the Norse sagas in the original. That's something. He was a great reader and a writer, and you can see the evidence of this when you visit his home at Sagamore Hill. Now, obviously, the first thing you notice at Sagamore Hill are the hunting trophies. They're everywhere, in every room except two, the Roosevelt's bedroom and Edith Roosevelt's sitting room. She put her foot down. No trophies here, Theodore. By the way, he didn't like the nickname Teddy and did not go by it. And he once said, even my wife doesn't call me Teddy. But then, get past the hunting trophies. The next thing you'll notice, you can't help noticing, are the books. That house literally overflows with books. Theodore Roosevelt was a natural speed reader who consumed 3 or 4 books a day, no matter what else he was doing, whether he was president, governor, secretary, assistant secretary of the Navy, what else. As a matter of fact, he wrote a study of Oliver Cromwell while he was governor of New York by dictating it while he was being shaved in the morning. His life before and after the presidency were a continuous adventure. He served in the New York state legislature right out of Harvard. Then he ran for the mayor of New York when he was 28. He was the New York City police commissioner and then assistant secretary of the Navy when he was in his 30s. He was elected governor of New York when he was 40. And then, of course, at the same time, he was also a rancher in the Dakota Territory, and he led his cavalry regiment, the Rough Riders, in that heroic charge up San Juan Hill. That's what he really called his crowded hour. He left the presidency when he had just turned 50. He was younger when he left the White House than all but four men have been when they entered it. Then he went on that famous big game safari to Africa. And after that, he ran against his handpicked successor for the Republican nomination for president in 1912. And when he didn't get the nomination, he formed his own new party, the Progressives. Their mascot, of course, was the Bull Moose. In that election, he came in a strong second. He is the only third-party candidate who has ever polled more votes than a major party nominee. After that, he led an expedition to explore the jungles of the Amazon and almost lost his life there. At the time of his death in 1919, he was the odds-on favorite for the Republican nomination for president in 1920, and he would have been the next president. It's always made me think, what would have been like if we'd gone into the 1920s with Theodore Roosevelt as president again? This is just a bare and very, very selective recital, but I think it gives you a hint of the life he led. But I've left out the presidency. And T.R., and by the way, that's his favorite nickname, T.R. without the presidency is Hamlet without the Prince of Denmark. The 7.5 years he spent in this house were the happiest in his life. Mrs. Bush has given us a taste of what a fun, madcap place it was. And Sargent said his problem with painting that portrait was to get him to stand still long enough to do it. And he got him to stand there. Notice that's the finial that he's got his hand on. There's a famous photo of him with his hand on a globe. And frankly, I've confused it, and most of us confuse it. They think of that portrait as actually having his hand on the world there. Great symbolism. He hated to leave. He really hated to leave this place. His presidency earned him a place on Mount Rushmore. Now, it also helped that the sculptor of Mount Rushmore, Gutzon Borglum, was a friend and admirer. There's a term we use these days to measure presidents, the Mount Rushmore standard. I think it's worth asking whether this man meets that standard. Now, according to us academics and others, there are two tests of a president. One is what did he, and someday she, do? Well, by that standard, T.R. measures up very well. Panama Canal, mediating the Russo-Japanese War. That made him the first American to win the Nobel Prize for Peace. The Food and Drug Administration, the U.S. Forest Service. I think it's safe to say that he was the first and remains the greatest environmental president. There's another test, too, though, about a president. What did he, someday she, bring to and give to this office? Here is where I think T.R. really towers. He invented the modern presidency. He did that by exploiting its public dimensions. That term of his, bully pulpit, did not mean just a platform for advancing his ideas and programs. He meant something much more. He meant educating the public and inspiring people to service and to sacrifice. T.R. really created the model for the strong president, someone interested and active in every area, someone who sets the national agenda, someone who skillfully operates at home and abroad to get things done. Every effective president since then has followed in his footsteps. And none more so than his distant cousin, the man who had the same last name and who was married to his niece, Franklin Roosevelt. T.R. finally created the model of the president as a national leader. That is, someone who draws the people together to face problems and adversaries. And Uncle Ted, as they called him, was FDR's role model when he faced the Depression and World War II. And it's a role model that is and must be very much with us today. Theodore Roosevelt remains one of our best remembered presidents, and deservedly so. He claimed closer than anybody ever has done to being a president for all seasons. And with that, I will give you President Roosevelt.
Tremendous, tremendous, delighted to see you all. Tremendous, wonderful to see you all. Wonderful, delighted to see you all. Mr. President and Mrs. Bush, honored guests and indeed family members. A sesquicentennial is a very hard thing to say, but it's a wonderfully fun thing to do. I want to thank you so much for this celebration of my 150th birthday. Now, indeed, some have asked, Mr. President, why are you back with us 150 years after your birth, a century after your presidency, indeed, you know, 90 years after my corporal demise? Well, indeed, let me put to rest a pernicious rumor. There is no truth in it. I have not returned because someone needs a hunting lesson. No, indeed. You may know that my daughter Alice famously said of me, Father wanted to be the bride at every wedding, the corpse at every funeral, and the baby at every baptism. Do you think I would miss my birthday in that case? Well, I must say, I like what you've done with the place. You know that when I became president, it was because in September of 1901, the American people and its government suffered a cowardly attack. And how appropriate tonight on my birthday celebration that President McKinley looks down upon us. Now, in September of 2001, again, the American people and its government suffered a cowardly attack. And Mr. President, on behalf of the American people, I tell you, sir, that your response and your leadership has been in the spirit of speak softly and carry a big stick, and we, sir, are with you. It was not only doubtful that I would ever get to the White House, but it was doubtful that I would live as a young boy. You know, I was a weak and sickly child. I had asthma. My father, the best man I ever knew, got me life and got me breath, often keeping me aloft in the night, having the horses tied to the carriage, and the carriage would speed through New York, getting air to my young lungs. My father came to me concerned as I continued to be a weak boy, and he said, Theodore, you have the mind, but you have not the body. And without the aid of the body, the mind cannot go as far as it otherwise might. It is hard work and drudgery, but you must make your body. I said, Father, I shall. And I set out to do exercises, to do calisthenics, parallel bars, the rings, to lift weights, indeed, even to take boxing lessons in the classical manner. And I built my body. And it does appear I may have overdone it just a bit. But when I was in the White House at 5'8" and 220 pounds, you know I was but a mere feather of a man compared to my successor, William Howard Taft. At times, Taft tipped the scales at over 350 pounds. When I was the president and Taft, my governor in the Philippines, we had word that he was in ill health with fever, perhaps near death. Secretary of State John Hay cabled inquiring as to his health, and thankfully, Taft cabled back, health fine, rode horse 20 miles this morning. Hay cabled back, how's the horse? Mr. President, thank you for living the vigorous life, and with the folks at the National Park Service, getting Americans outdoors, into the woods, and for great adventure, and bully to see Boone and Crockett here too. Hunters are still the great conservationists in America. I delighted in hearing the stories of life in the White House. You know, when I did come into office, that first evening in the White House, September 22nd, 1901, with my two sisters having dinner with me, I realized it was my father's birthday. And indeed, I never took a major decision without wondering what that great man did and what he thought. Mr. President, you know the feeling when I say my father was the greatest man I ever knew. Now, indeed, the children were a handful. Have you heard about Archie and Quentin, the members of the Secret Service and the Washington, D.C. police officers called them the White House Gang, along with their friends? I share one story that I believe is illustrative. There was a winter day. I came out onto the White House driveway. I ascended into the White House carriage, and indeed, a police officer gave me a crisp salute, and just as the fingertips of his hand hit the brim of his helmet, so did a giant 30-pound snowball drop from the White House roof. The snowball smashed through his helmet and left the officer knocked out cold on the driveway. I didn't need to look or investigate. I turned over my shoulder and said, "Boys, get down here immediately." Down they came. We awoke the officer, cleaned him up. The boys apologized, rightly so. And you may appreciate that as an executive manager, I looked into the issue, and indeed, the man was long overdue for a promotion. Here in the White House, I boxed with army officers. I wrestled jiu-jitsu and sumo with great men that the Japanese ambassador brought to me. Indeed, my most favorite fun was hiking point to point out in Rock Creek and beyond. You may know that I invited so many to come with me and discovered that too many of our officers in the Army and Navy were in need of better conditioning. But famous is the time I invited the French ambassador, Jules Jusserand, to be with me. And we hiked and we hiked. We had rules on a point to point. When you come to an obstacle, a down tree, a river, a cliff, you never went around the obstacle, but always over it, under it, or through it. Tremendous fun. But on our hike, it being a hot day, the ambassador was greatly relieved when we came to the Potomac. He thought surely, it being a very wide, deep, and fast portion of the river, it was our terminus. We'd return to the White House for refreshments. I turned to the party with me. I said, "Gentlemen, let us take off our clothes, put the bundles atop our heads, swim the river, put our clothes back on dry, and continue our hike." We all did so, but the ambassador, I noticed as we got into the water, had kept on his kid gloves. I said, "Mr. Ambassador, why have you kept on your gloves?" He said, "Mr. President, that's in case we meet any ladies." I had a wonderful life. I, on election night 1904, told the assembled press, under no circumstances would I run for a third term. I would indeed recognize the Washingtonian tradition of serving no more than two terms, the term I completed for President McKinley being my first, this now being my second. And Mrs. Roosevelt winced on hearing that. Later that night, she said, "Theodore, that was not a very wise thing to say. I declared myself a lame duck. And if I had problems with Congress in my first administration, imagine them in my second. I was a progressive president, believing in the power of the executive. And I can tell you, in my terms, I understood that the opposite of progress was too often Congress." But I hope you appreciate that I got some things done for the American people and the people of the world. Indeed, in foreign policy, I think the most important thing we accomplished was to dig the great Panama Canal. And at the end of my term, to send the Navy around the world, the great white fleet, to prove that we could do in peacetime what might be necessary to do in wartime. Domestically, does anything compare, Mr. Secretary, with the tremendous wonder of the national parks, our national forests, refuges, and monuments, 230 million acres added to the protection of the people? But I share with you, in my life, I had tragedy, I had failure. You know, early in my political career, I ran for the mayor of New York. I came in third, out of three. But remember, as you go forward, so many of you, community leaders and public servants, when you do your good deeds, you know you will be criticized. Remember what I told the French at the Sorbonne in 1910, and I tell you now, and this perhaps is the most wonderful thing, that these words are stenciled on the flight deck of the USS Theodore Roosevelt, the Navy's big stick. As you hear them, please say a silent prayer for the men and women of all of our armed services deployed in harm's way. Remember, it is not the critic who counts, not the man who points out how the strong man stumbles or where the doer of deeds could have done better. The credit belongs to the man, and today to the woman who's actually in the arena, whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood, who strives valiantly, who errs and comes up short again and again, because there is no effort without error or shortcoming, but who knows the great devotions, the great enthusiasms, who spends himself in a worthy cause, and who, in the end, at the best, knows the triumph of high achievement, and who, at the worst, if he fails, at least he fails while daring greatly, that his name shall never be with those cold and timid souls who know neither victory nor defeat. Now indeed. Thank you. I share with you that after my presidency, after hunting in Africa with Kermit, you know, J.P. Morgan toasted our leaving New York Harbor, thusly in his library, to the lions. May they do their job. But we came back from Africa and Europe, and I became concerned about what was going on in America, and I ran for the presidency again, first as a Republican, then as a bold moose progressive independent. And in 1912, on October 14th in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, I was shot in the chest by an assassin. I spit into my palm, being a hunter. I checked, there was no blood in my spittle. My lung was not punctured, it was but a mere flesh wound. I demanded to go and speak to the auditorium with the bullet in my chest. I pulled my jacket aside, showed the audience my blouse, and said, "You must excuse me, you may not understand. I've just been shot." "But it takes more than a bullet to kill a bull moose." And I spoke for 80 minutes. And right now, the social officer of the White House is wondering if it will take a handgun to get me to stop speaking now. I assure you, madam, I am concluding, but I conclude with this. Perhaps it is, amongst all the things that are known, the Panama Canal, pure food and drug, good laws and a square deal for the American people, perhaps I'm known best for a failed bear hunt. I tell you, I hope that each and every one of you will make sure that the children of this country, especially those in the children's hospitals, that they have a teddy bear. And if you would like to help support that, you may inquire of the Theodore Roosevelt Association, now building a great museum for me in Oyster Bay, Long Island, New York. And this indeed, at theodoreroosevelt.org, is one of their wonderful signal accomplishments to bring teddy bears and the love and comfort therein to the sick children of our country. I can think of nothing better as a legacy. I congratulate each and every one of you on being here this evening, and you are in for a treat. Can you imagine a New York dude like me with a Harvard education getting off of a Union Pacific train in 1883 in Medora, North Dakota, with the intent of hunting buffalo and buying a cattle ranch? I would have never been president but for my time in the Dakotas. Indeed, it was the Wild West, the time of Owen Wister's stories and Frederick Remington's drawings and paintings. And it is a Wild West and a love of the Dakotas that will come to you tonight in the wonderful music of Mr. Job Christensen and Mr. Joel Gilbertson, who will play the piano and sing for you tonight about that wonderful territory, Dakota. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. President and Mrs. First Lady, God bless and keep you all. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It's such an honor to be here tonight. Yes, we are from North Dakota, and we are very proud, and we like to take credit for the formative years of Teddy Roosevelt, what made him a great leader, and we celebrate great leadership and great legacies tonight. Mr. President, First Lady, thank you so much. We celebrate your legacy as well.
Every night that I spend here without you, I'm longing for the day that you'll come home. Wherever you may travel, I'll be with you. No matter where you are, you're not alone. Though we're miles apart, I know deep in my heart it'll only be a while until I see you smile and you'll come home to know. honorary song. You've been away too long, so come home to North Dakota. North Dakota is the place where you belong. Across the 10 Dakota land, the sun is slowly fading. Shadows of the night are coming on. Another day has slipped away, and still she goes on waiting, waiting for the one who sang this song. Medora, Medora, I'll be coming back to you. Wild and free, she waits for me coming home. Wild and free, she waits for me coming home. So come home to North Dakota. Come hear the prairie song. You've been away too long, so come home to North Dakota. And North Dakota is the place where you belong. Wild and free, she waits for me coming home to Medora.
Thank you all. Please be seated. Don't be seated. Thank you all very much. Job, thank you for the fantastic performance. John Milton Cooper, we appreciate you reading. I had an interesting piece of history dropped on me tonight by Mrs. Cooper. They met on Capitol Hill when she was an intern for Senator Prescott S. Bush, father of President 41, grandfather of President 43. And we welcome you both here. Thank you for coming. And of course, it's good to see President Roosevelt. Oftentimes people ask me, do you ever see any of the ghosts of your predecessors here in the White House? I said, no, I quit drinking. But we just saw one. Members of the Cabinet, thank you for coming. Former governor of North Dakota, now the Secretary of Agriculture, is with us. That last song must have made you feel pretty good, Governor. I'm proud to be here with Congressman Pete King. Thanks for coming, Congressman. Appreciate you and your wife coming. The Roosevelt family. Members of the Roosevelt family are here tonight. We welcome you back to the White House. Distinguished guests, Laura and I are thrilled that you came to celebrate the 150th birthday of one of the greatest statesmen in our nation's history, Theodore Roosevelt. I call him Theodore. Occasionally call him TR. We remember many of our presidents as leaders made for a unique moment in our history. President Roosevelt, as John said, was a man for all seasons. He was a soldier who won the Medal of Honor, a peacemaker who won the Nobel Prize. He was one of the world's most daring big game hunters and a leading advocate for conservation of our country's natural resources. He was an intellectual who sometimes read several books a day, as John mentioned, and he wrestled here at the White House. He was a man who felt at home on a sprawling ranch in the West. He believed in the importance of a strenuous life of exercise. I can relate to that. President Roosevelt also is an advocate for simplifying spelling in America. During his presidency, one member of Congress said that President Roosevelt's efforts would create confusion and discord in the English language. I can relate to that. Nearly 100 years after his presidency, Theodore Roosevelt's legacy still endures here at the White House. Laura gave you an account of the legacy that still endures. He endures in the West Wing as well. Right across the door of the Oval Office is what was his former office, known as the Roosevelt Room. Above the fireplace hangs a portrait of the 26th president on horseback during the Spanish-American War. That portrait is a reminder. When I look at it, I think about the character and courage that is necessary for any president. For the past 8 years, his legacy has been an inspiration to me. It will be an inspiration to the person who replaces me, and it will be an inspiration for all presidents to come. We thank you for joining us. And please now join us for a reception in the state dining room. God bless.